This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have a new clue about how we evolved from our primate ancestors. It was just reported that the first nearly complete skull of our earliest known upright walking ancestor was discovered in Ethiopia. The skull is about 3 million years old. It was uncovered by a team led by paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson. 20 years ago in Ethiopia, he discovered the oldest primate skeleton ever uncovered. He called the skeleton Lucy and concluded that it represented the missing link in evolution between humans and apes. But that skeleton lacked a head, so the conclusions he drew were controversial. Johansson says the recently discovered skull is part of the same species as Lucy and clears up some of the controversy. The skull indicates that Lucy had a small brain, an ape-like jutting jaw, and thick protruding ridges above the eyes. Johansson recently hosted a PBS Nova series and has written a companion book called Ancestors: In Search of Human Origins. Earlier today, he told me what the 3-million-year-old skull adds to our understanding of Lucy's place in evolutionary history.
Well, in 1974, when I found Lucy, she certainly shook up the anthropological world because we determined that she was of extreme antiquity, about 3.2 million years old, and she represented a new kind of human ancestor. In our lingo, a new species belonging to a terrible tongue twister, Australopithecus afarensis. And she precipitated a tremendous amount of debate, and I think to a large extent because most of her skull was missing. We were unable to find the remains of her skull that I suspect were washed away and have broken up and disappeared forever. So 20 years later, with the discovery and now announcement of a skull of her species, we have a solid idea of what those skulls looked like, and it gives us a much better vision of what this earliest human ancestor looked like.
Lucy had been seen as the missing link, the connection between ape and man. How did Lucy revise the theory of human origins?
When I discovered Lucy in 1974, she told us a number of things immediately. If we take a step back and consider even what Charles Darwin said over a century ago, there were three major things that went together in terms of human evolutionary change. One of them was stone tool making, the other was brain expansion, and the third one, which I think is most obvious to all of us, is the acquisition of a new kind of locomotion. Rather than walking around using a stable mode of locomotion like most primates do on four legs, our ancestors stood up and walked on two legs. And Darwin suggested, well, they stood up to make these stone tools, and in order to make those tools, they had to have large brains. Well, Lucy has never been associated with any stone tools. Stone tools don't appear in the archaeological record till at least 750,000 years after Lucy. And Lucy had a very small brain. So what she did, with what we did with this single discovery, was we uncoupled Darwin's trilogy, or trinity, I suppose, that our ancestors stood up and walked in a bipedal fashion long before they began to fashion tools and long before they began to expand their brains.
And I guess the discovery of the skull, which has a small cranium for a small brain, helps to prove that point.
It certainly does. It reinforces the idea. The skull is about 200,000 years younger than Lucy. That's roughly, if we have a 20-year-long generation period, about 10,000 generations younger. And what is astonishing about it, I think in some ways, is that it is still quite primitive. That was one of the most interesting aspects of Lucy, of this species afarensis, that from the neck up, they were very primitive, very ape-like. They had projecting faces. They had a brain about a third the size of our own. They had ape-like teeth, but clearly they were standing upright. Now, this skull that's 200,000 years younger than Lucy is still very primitive. It's a large skull, probably a male, an older male. His teeth were fairly heavily worn, so I suspect that he lived into his late 20s, early 30s. but still had a very projecting face and a very small brain case and strong muscle markings on the skull.
So if this skull and the Lucy skeleton help prove that our primate ancestors walked on 2 feet before they had a developed enough brain to actually use tools, what information does that give us about evolution? Like and about what happened when primates started to walk on 2 feet, how that changed the kinds of lives they led?
Well, two of the areas we're most interested in all evolutionary studies, whether we're studying the evolution of humans or the evolution of horses or antelopes or whatever, are the tempo and mode of evolutionary change. What I mean by that is the speed of evolutionary change and the character that evolutionary change manifests. We know that in terms of the mode of evolutionary change, the first thing that happened in the origins of modern humans, of the human family, was that our ancestors stood up. And I think we'll return to that and talk about that a little bit because it is a very interesting question. And the other thing that we've learned from this skull that's so interesting is that there was apparently a very long period of time, on the order of 1 million years, because this skull has allowed us now to go back and look at some previous discoveries which were made in the early 1980s that were sort of in scientific limbo. We didn't know exactly where they belonged, what species to call them. And because this skull is so complete, about 75 to 80% complete, we were able to look at especially the frontal region, just above the orbits of the eyes, and to look at this 3.9 million-year-old skull fragment, and they're identical. And that means that in terms of the tempo of evolutionary change, the rate of evolutionary change, we're looking at a long period of stability or stasis in a species, Lucy's species, Afarensis, that perhaps stretched over 1 million years of time.
That's much slower than we thought.
Well, I think that Darwin's view was a very gradualistic view. He felt that there were very small micro changes that happen each generation. Steve Gould, a colleague of mine at Harvard, and Niles Eldridge at the American Museum of Natural History have suggested, on the basis of literally dozens, maybe hundreds of different species of, whether it be a shell-like thing like a brachiopod or whatever, or a trilobite, that for most of the life of that species, it doesn't change very dramatically. But it's in sort of a state of equilibrium. But something comes along, maybe climatic change, and punctuates that equilibrium. It disturbs that equilibrium. And there are three choices that species make. Not consciously, but there are three different directions that they could go in. They could go extinct if they can't adapt to the new environment. They can adapt and change. Or they can try to follow the old environment as it's moving away. And I think that what we're looking at with this new skull is a very, very important datum at about 3.0 million years ago, which is right on the cusp of a creative of an adaptive explosion that will give rise to several different lineages. And it appears to fit this model of long stasis, rapid change, other periods of stasis, and more rapid change again.
So the rapid change was walking on 2 feet.
Well, the rapid change came. The rapid change I'm talking about is subsequent to this skull, somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million years ago. Walking on two legs is the sort of the major question that I think has captivated people over the last couple of decades, because when we look at it, it's a terrible mode of locomotion. It's slow. It's clumsy. If you're living on the African savanna with a bunch of fast four-legged, you know, quadrupeds who have one thing and only one thing in mind, to have you for breakfast or supper, it doesn't appear to be a very interesting and successful adaptation. Yet we know that it is a very odd adaptation. There are only two primates that have ever walked upright, ourselves and Lucy-like creatures. So there must have been a tremendous evolutionary payoff, a reproductive advantage for standing upright. And in order to understand that, we have to look back almost 10 to 15 million years ago, when all of Europe, most of Asia, Southeast Asia, and Africa were populated by tens of different kinds of species of apes. Apes were everywhere. It was called the Age of the Apes. And about 10 million years ago, the climate began to change, forests were disappearing, and a much faster primate in terms of reproduction began to take over the scene, and these were the monkeys. Monkeys can reproduce themselves and their mate in about 6 years. A typical African ape today, like a chimpanzee, takes 21 years to reproduce itself and its mate to maintain zero population growth. So if it loses one of those infants when it's 20 years old, it has to start over again. What Owen Lovejoy at Kent State believes is that early hominids now stood up because it enabled them to use their forelimbs, which now become their upper limbs,
their hands,
to carry large amounts of foodstuff back to a home base to share with mates so that females could have more numbers, higher numbers of dependent offspring.
So you think that walking on 2 feet, the evolutionary advantage of that is that you could use your arms and hands. They're free to use tools. They're free to carry food. And then you kind of connect that to the development of like a primate version of nuclear family.
That's right. I think that the carrying, it always sounds very simplistic when we talk about it, but if we look at chimpanzees today, a female chimp will spend almost 60% of her daily foraging time to look for things like termites, insects, small vertebrates. She's looking for protein. She's looking for amino acids. She's looking for fats. And these are incredibly important, even though they only constitute about 5% of her diet. If males and females who were not pregnant, lactating, taking care of offspring, were able to forage widely and carry back larger amounts of high-quality food, thus adding new energy into this social unit, the females that were bearing offspring would be able to have more than at one single time. In other words, they could have a child every couple of years instead of doing it every 6 or 7 years.
Because they'd have more protein?
Because there'd be a lot more energy, you see, because an individual animal has to forage for food for itself, which exposes it to danger, mm-hmm. uses up energy in itself, and makes it difficult to care for offspring. If she can stay in one spot and that high-energy food can be brought to her, she can, in fact, reduce the risk of accident. She can reduce the search time for food. She can use that energy to look after her offspring in terms of lactation. She can get pregnant sooner. She can reduce birth spacing, which apes cannot do because they are individually oriented animals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson. He found the skeleton known as Lucy, and that's the oldest anatomical evidence of primates that walked on 2 feet. And now his group has discovered the oldest primate skull. Donald Johansson is also the author of the book Ancestors in Search of Human Origins. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson, his latest discovery, his group found a primate skull that's considered the oldest primate skull ever to be found, about 3 million years old. Would you remember for us the day when you found this skeleton of Lucy?
This was the discovery of Lucy was back in 1974. I hate to admit that it was 20 years ago, but where did those 2 decades disappear to so fast? I had just gotten my union card, my PhD at the University of Chicago, and I was co-directing with some French colleagues my first major expedition in Africa. I had worked on other expeditions beginning in 1970, but this was really my first major sort of coming out with my doctorate in hand. And it was a Sunday afternoon. I was out surveying with one of my graduate students, Tom Gray, and it was around noon, which means the temperatures were climbing to 110, 120 degrees, and the only thing we were thinking about then was heading back to camp and going for a swim in the river. And there was a small area, really, not much larger than the studio that I'm sitting in here in San Francisco. And it was a patch of ground that for some reason we had ignored during the morning. We had not really taken an in-depth look at it. And as I was walking along, for what reason, whatever reason, I looked over my right shoulder and spied on the ground a piece of arm, which was clearly from the elbow region. And as I kneeled down to look at it, I could tell from its diagnostic anatomy that it wasn't a monkey, wasn't an antelope, it couldn't be anything else, it had to be one of these human ancestors. But I wasn't prepared for looking up the slope and seeing a bit of a pelvis, a bit of a leg, a bit of a foot, eroding out. And right there in that noonday sun, I realized, throwing my arms around each other, the two of us throwing our arms around each other, realizing that what we had struck upon was what would ultimately become one of the great finds of the century.
So you realize that you're looking at these positively ancient fossils that are going to be an incredible discovery. And what do you do to protect them as soon as you realize what you've discovered?
Well, the first thing we did after we overcame our excitement, we went to the car, we drove back to camp, we brought the team out and showed them the pieces before they were even touched. And then we took a series of stakes and gridded out in a typical archaeological way the area and systematically collected each square, mapping each bone as it was found, and then put in a small excavation in the hillside and ultimately ended up with nearly 40% of a skeleton that is dated at 3.2 million years. These bones are completely fossilized, completely changed to stone, so they really don't need much care and preparation. We put a thin coating on them of a glue which keeps small pieces of the bone from flaking off. But she's back in Ethiopia now, stored in a safe, nestled in a bed of yellow foam, and those bones are pretty darn stable.
So do you have some kind of cast of Lucy while her real bones are stored in this vault?
Oh, yes. We were able, this was before the laboratory was built in Addis Ababa. There is now a wonderful laboratory at the National Museum where the fossils are all stored and can be worked on. But in the mid-70s, there wasn't a facility like this, and we brought these bones back to the United States. I was director of scientific research at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, and I won't forget that January afternoon landing on an absolutely frozen runway, as they often are at that time of year in Cleveland, with Lucy sitting in a suitcase under the seat in front of me. And here she had come from her ancient resting place in the Horn of Africa to Cleveland, and stayed there for 5 years when we did all of our studies. We made photographs, we cleaned the specimens, we made molds of them. So we have very excellent casts of the specimen, which can still be used for comparative studies, for example.
Now, are you superstitious, or do you worry a lot? Like, for instance, when you were carrying the fossils onto the plane, did you worry that they were going to make you check it in baggage, you know? Or that in the cab ride over, there'd be some kind of auto accident, and you'd like, hurt the bones in any way?
Well, certainly she didn't leave my side, whether in the hotel or in the airport or whatever. And the place I was most worried was Paris. Because I don't know if you've been through Paris recently, but even back then, everything has to be x-rayed, everything has to be opened up, and the French gendarmes at the airport are very officious about all of this. And one of Lucy's bones, her thigh bone or femur, when it goes through the x-ray machine, invariably looks like a pistol. And most places, they didn't say anything, but my worst fears came true in Paris, because this suitcase went through the x-ray machine, and they pulled me aside, and they told me that they wanted to open this. And often when they do this, you know, they just sort of rip through things. And I explained to them in not terribly good French that these were very delicate specimens. And he said, well, what are they? And I said, well, they're very old fossils. And this other guy, this older guy, mustached fellow, came over smoking a Gauloise, and he says, could this be Lucy, because it was in Le Monde, in the newspaper, and when they found out it was Lucy, they wanted to see it even more. So we zippered open this little brown American Tourister bag and took out a couple of pieces, and these Frenchmen said that they will never forget the thrill of holding a 3.2-million-year-old ancestor, and then, of course, they couldn't do enough for me.
I've read that you've named your fossils Lucy, because you used to play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds a lot in the camp back in 1974 when you made the discovery. Did you ever wish you'd named her something else?
Absolutely not. I think it's just a wonderful name, and it came up in a serendipitous way. We were listening to a tape. I said, let's call her Lucy, and that's how she got her name.
And do you have to name the skull now?
No, I don't think so. It's got a scientific number, and it's called 444, and I think it's going to stay that way. All of these fossils are so important because each and every one of them is a link, and a very important link in the sense that it reminds and should remind every reader today who's looking at it in the New York Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer or the San Francisco Chronicle that this is an important link to our past, to our origins, that we, Homo sapiens, got here through the same process as all other life, and that we are still part of the natural world. And if we learn nothing else from this, we need to embrace the idea that we have a common origin, a common beginning, regardless of how people look or act or what color their skin is. We are all from a common beginning. And furthermore, we have to embrace the view that we are part of the natural world. We are now responsible for the outcome of the natural world. And it's my hope that the species, Homo sapiens, will make choices about how we treat and use and care for the natural world that are not just good choices for ourselves, but also for all our fellow travelers.
Donald Johanson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Donald Johanson has written a new book called Ancestors: In Search of Human Origins. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.